And we're here today as part of the Science Now trip around here. We've got Hollywood meets the lab coats. And the chair is Rod Quantock, just in case you're wondering. That's the chair that is Rod Quantock. We have a panel, ladies and gentlemen, of international and local experts who are going to dissect Hollywood's approach to science. As part of the afternoon, we will be viewing on that screen some clips from Hollywood movies extending back to the 30s right up to the present day, and we'll be looking at how Hollywood either got it right, got it wrong, or set an agenda, perhaps, for modern science. So I'll introduce to you the panel, just one at a time, and we have... Oh, wow. No, you'll be impressed. From Henbest Productions, producer of the BB series The Universe, which I... Anybody not see The Universe on ABC? There you go. So you all... That's the kind of people... That's the kind of people they are. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, all the way from the United Kingdom, she is not only a producer of things like The Universe, she actually knows what she's talking about because she's also an astronomer. Ladies and gentlemen, Heather Cooper! Bum-ba-da-bum-ba-bum! Heather, you climb up on the stage. For somebody who stares at the stars, you're hopeless on Earth, aren't you? Try again. Ready? I'm braced now. Oh!
One day,
yeah.
I will grow legs.
Okay, all right, thank you very much. So Heather has arrived, very graciously. You're on Team 1.
Yeah.
Heather, you're playing for Home Viewer, Norma Barnicle of Mount Eliza. And if your team wins, Nora gets a trip on the space shuttle one way. She'll be a science experiment.
Thank you.
Next, we have science communicator, well-known to all ABC viewers and listeners, Gail Jennings. You're right? Good, okay. Well, introduce some taller people in a moment. Research director with the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, David Vaux. Welcome, David. Oh, you're short too. Come on, David, I'll give you a hand. Very, very good. Would you mind just coming and making a step? Just bend down and be a step for us. Thank you very much. Science at work. Isn't the human body a remarkable thing? Next, wearing football boots with stops, the director of our Mind, Body and Soul program at the Museum of Victoria, David Smith. And incidentally, he did it all himself. The museum is due to open in October of this year, so not far to go at all. Film critic, and this is very important, and cinema studies academic at the University of Melbourne, please welcome Barbara Creed. Well done, Barbara. Thank you very much. I hope your other women were looking at how Barbara did that by herself. And finally, managing director of Aerospace Education International, who are working with Spacehab Inc. to bring the STARS program to Australia. Please welcome Mr. Kevin Manning. And your home viewer is Barry Unsworth of New South Wales. Would you mind playing for John Howard? I didn't realise it was a one-way trip on the space shuttle, so we might make him our own viewer. Now, we've got a number of clips for you to watch, ladies and gentlemen. And what we'll be doing, as I say, is showing them up here. We'll have a look at them, our panel will discuss them, and try and put them into context in terms of how science understands the world and how Hollywood tries so desperately hard to get it right. But we're going to look at movie monsters next, and our first clip is from I'm going to quote here, an uneasy and ambivalent movie. It attempts to subvert the intentions of Heinlein's novel, I don't know who he was, but he wrote, which praises the notion of a military elite, yet it remains true to the original's enjoyment of violent battles and military superiority. It suggests that individuality is a luxury the future cannot afford. Do you know what film it is? Starship Trooper.
Oh, right.
Why do you bother coming? You're so smart. You're smarter than us. From 1997, Starship Trooper.
Warm it all up. Everything you've got. Come
male fantasy stuff.
Well, yeah, and isn't it interesting? There's no women in any of these.
Would you notice the only
women? Well, that's why
was,
we're not
it
there.
It was an allegory.
Stupid.
The monsters were women.
Oh, okay. I was pleased to at least see a woman in the last clip with a role to play, like she was an astronaut. But otherwise, they're either attachments or not there at all.
This isn't true with the Alien films, where we get Ripley, who's the heroine of all four. But I think the monsters in this film are... Well, they're totally lifted out of the Alien films to start with.
Yeah.
And they're awful. I mean, they're just not very convincing at all. I just think the special effects are really shoddy. Compared
this
to...
is only 3 years ago. You'd expect something
a little.
Yeah, I know,
but, the original Alien, which to me is, the apart from 2001, the best horror film ever, the best science fiction made, is 79.
Mm,
this is 20 years later, and it looks like we've gone back to the 30s.
Is this thought of, though, as a B-grade movie, or was this a major movie?
Well, it's a major director, Paul Verhoeven, and I think it had a big following, this movie, and the people here obviously saw it a lot. But I agree with Gail that the floating monsters look kind of like giant grasshoppers of some sort, don't they?
Yeah, I would say it was 1939 rather than 79. I mean, they really look so old-fashioned.
Yes.
Yeah. Babe got it better. I prefer Babe as well. I'm like you. I don't like frightening movies.
But the mother alien, is, I think, an incredible image of monstrosity and terror and fear and so forth from the Alien films. She has blood. Her blood is acid and... She just keeps reproducing. And I think what those films are all about are society's anxieties about reproductive technologies and cloning. And I think, you find... If you trace the science fiction film through each generation, you'll find that in the 50s it's anxiety about atomic weapons. Later on, with films like Soylent Green and so forth, it's anxieties about population and lack of food. And then we get films now, a lot of films being made, like Species, about the horrors of cloning that are really coming into their own in science fiction now. So, it has a symbolic function, science fiction, in a way, whereby the society kind of uses science fiction to talk to itself about its current anxieties, I think.
So the anxieties about GMOs at the moment were previewed by the giant Killer Tomatoes films.
Well, look, we've got a little clip still from the same movie, Starship Trooper, and this is a little scene of dissection, and it'll raise some issues about life forms on other planets and whether they will in fact visit. This is pretty gruesome too, girls and boys.
Oh. Now, come on, it's just a bug. Better put your goggles on.
Just a bug. We humans like to think we are nature's finest achievement. I'm afraid it just isn't true. This archaic sand beetle is superior in many ways. It reproduces in vast numbers. Has no ego, has no fear, doesn't know about death, and so is the perfect selfless member of society.
But humans have created art, mathematics, and interstellar travel.
True, but before you let that go to your head, take the example of the arachnids, a highly evolved insect society. By human standards, they are relatively stupid, but... their evolution stretches over millions of years. And now...
here, take this.
They can colonize planets by hurling their spore into space.
Ah, fantastic. The very first question, either to either of the...
It brought me back to my days in medical school.
Well, I was going to say, barehanded dissection. Is this advisable?
Goodness knows what pathogens you'd find in those sort of creatures. I mean, my goodness, I'd be washing my hands very thoroughly. But did you notice the blind lecturer walking around? How did she know where to switch that screen on?
She was a woman.
Pointed to the screen. Intuition.
If it had been a man, he would have been still fiddling.
And she got it wrong, too.
Did she?
Insects are not arachnids.
I noticed that as well.
Yeah.
But
big mistake.
The really cool thing is that what I was really amused by, first of all, I'm vegetarian, so I nearly sixed up at that point. And secondly, when we actually get samples back from Mars in about the year 2008, NASA has appointed what is called a planetary protection officer, which will make sure that no bugs or any diseases viruses actually come out of these samples brought back from Mars. And we hope, and here was this thing being dissected and all this bugs being offered up to the whole world. So maybe we've got things a bit more right now.
And it was interesting, just as a layperson, it was interesting to note that what was pulled out of there is a layperson's idea of what you'd find inside anything you cut up, lots of intestinal things.
Actually, it didn't look too bad, actually. I mean, it obviously seemed to come from a mammal, what was coming out of there, all the big long intestines and things, not very insect-like, I don't think.
No.
That's what you want, lots of nice squishy stuff that looks as if it smells really putrid and seemed to work.
Okay. So, David, out of 5 stars, you'd give that movie...
Minus two,
okay. Well, we won't even bother talking about it. We're going to get into a real monster movie now. From 1933, which movie? King Kong, of course.
No.
The only movie made in 1933.
Oh,
look, because time will get ahead of us if we don't hurry up, we'll look at King Kong Lives, a more recent version of King Kong, and then we can perhaps have a chat about the nature of monsters on planet Earth. Here we go, King Kong Lives. Are we ready for this? Have I jumped ahead of you a bit? Shouldn't be long now. Sorry to stop it there. The consummation moment is really quite dramatic, and the maternity ward scene is quite moving. One of the first questions, I remember doing high school physics and discussing issues of how big creatures can actually get and perform. Is King Kong a possibility?
No, he's not actually. The reasons why we're actually written up beautifully in a wonderful little essay by a guy called J.B.S. Haldane, who's a very famous physiologist, and this essay was called On Being the Right Size.
Yes.
And he basically pointed out that if you increase an animal's size and keep the proportions the same, think of a man or a woman 60 feet high, to use his units of measurement, the mass of that person increases according to the third power, so it goes up 1,000-fold, but the cross-section of the bones only increases by the square, so they only increase 100 times. So what this means is that if King Kong tried to walk down the street, his thigh bones would snap every time he took a step. So it's not possible.
Not possible. So it's not a film based on reality, then.
But it's great fun, isn't
it's
it?
Not a doco.
Could you use genetic technology to introduce foreign genes to strengthen the bones so that you might end up with a genetically modified GMO, King Kong?
You could. You'd probably have to do something like clone it or cross it with something that's designed that way, like, say, a rhino, which has got very, very stout legs to take its great weight.
But what would
be
the point?
What you'd be looking at.
Yeah, but in a way, I mean, we are, you know, we human beings have actually evolved to the right constraints of the gravity of our own planet. So there'd be no point in making... we're sort of faster, better, cheaper versions of things. We move quickly, we think quickly, we react quickly. But you can imagine a planet where you could actually grow with low gravity, like the moon or one of the moons going around Jupiter, where you could, with a low gravity, you could grow these incredibly tall creatures who wouldn't actually have to breathe the air. They could actually have these lungs on their heads and things like that. You can imagine these weird aliens.
The same is true if you consider the way animals are in the ocean. So
yes,
you can get beyond the size you can get on land if you go into the
like
sea.
Whales.
So the long or squid, for example, they're completely different shape, and they're hundreds and hundreds of feet long.
Sure. I mean, I think it's fascinating, actually. I don't think that the movie makers have really taken on the oceans as an alien environment. I mean, it really is an alien environment. I mean, this time last week, I was actually on the Great Barrier Reef and just swimming amongst all these amazing organisms and thinking, gosh, what an alien world this is, and looking at manta rays. Yeah, oh, I wasn't thinking of Jaws, actually. Don't upset me. But it was really cool. It's so alien down there, and I think movie makers ought to make more of that environment.
Well, another minor inaccuracy was often they say that these dinosaurs are from the Jurassic period, when in actual fact we really know they're from the Pleistocene period.
So you were saying about alien worlds when we were talking about King Kong, and it is interesting how the movies are made on the big things that scare human beings, which is the unknown in any sort of the unknown and the mysterious. So while space is so different because it's physics, basically it's physics based, and this we're talking biology now, you know, animals and stuff, but there's still, you know, the horrible black parts of our own minds that we're scared of what is possible and where it might come from and where it might be, whether it's the deeps or the ocean or outer space or some phantasmagorical creature. Where was King Kong supposed to have come from?
Well, in the second movie,
it's actually set on a Skull Island, which is in the Pacific, and recently there's been some interesting articles on King Kong pointing out that all of the indigenous people, or the primitive inverted commas people who live with Kong, are actually black African, who couldn't possibly be living on that Pacific island, and that the film is probably made in 1933 in the Depression, and Kong, of course, goes to New York, where he runs amok and begins to tear New York down and attack white society. That at one level, it's argued that Kong, you know, it's about the fears about race riots which were taking place across America in the 30s, and that Kong kind of represented the possibility of a racial uprising amongst the poor black people.
Hence the threat to the poor little white thin damsel in distress.
That's right,
for that nasty big hairy.
But the other thing is, of course, he's totally sympathetic, Kong. I mean, monsters often are. I mean, I sympathise with him all the way through, as you do with lots of monsters, you know, Dracula and the Hunchback and
the so Wily
Godzilla.
But I haven't seen the second film, but the first film goes out of its way to make us feel sympathy for this creature taken from its natural environment and used as a freak show, I suppose.
Yes. And it's interesting, I think, that the creatures that you're supposed to feel empathy for are very human-like. E.T. was a sort of hyper baby, big eyes, big head, that sort of childlike form. King Kong has got lovely, warm expressions in his eyes. The other one, even more so. The two of those gorillas were really, ogling each other. But then if you want the creatures not to have empathy, they go towards those stick insects in the earlier film, you know, the praying mantis-like creatures and scary forms like bats, or these creatures that are in our mythology. They come from deep in our psyche, I think, the fear of spiders, lizards,
reptiles
and bats.
Go on.
Just quickly saying, I mean, just to corroborate what you said, there was a wonderful phrase which one of, Australian's top directors, Richard Smith, who works for the ABC, came up with about aliens and aliens in movies. And he said that the aliens and their appearance are dictated by the limitations of Hollywood budgets and the limitations of latex. And I think he was absolutely right.
Well, this is this next monster we're going to see is dictated by the limits of the Japanese monster budget. And this is one of the greats from 1955, Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
If we be assumed that 2 million years ago, this Brontosaurus and other ancient reptiles roamed the earth. It was known as the Jurassic Age. During this period, there was another species which we may call the intermediary animal, a cross between the land-living and the sea-living animals. A Let us call this creature Godzilla, according to the legend of Oda Island. And judging from this photograph, this creature is over 400 feet tall. Of course, the question we are asking ourselves is how this animal happened to reappear after all these centuries and so near to the coast of Japan. One answer could be that some rare phenomenon of nature allowed this breed of the Jurassic age to reproduce itself, and for a long span of time it had no reason to reappear to the world. But now that analysis of radioactivity of the creature's footprint shows the existence of strontium 90, a product of the H-bomb, it is my belief that Godzilla was resurrected due to the repeated experiments of H-bombs.
Well, they never made that sequel where Perry Mason actually sued Godzilla for all of that destruction.
So it was Perry Mason. My angle on it's not quite good. It was Perry Mason.
Yeah, what I loved about that movie, first of all, it was obviously a Japanese movie because they were all taking photographs. Loads of them all lined up. And the second thing was, what, the hero, the dark-haired guy, he kept just, he's posing and staring at the monster. Why didn't he just bugger off and get out of there?
Because they couldn't do a wide shot because it actually was a Japanese movie without him.
You're right. He was
cut in later, wasn't he? It's a classic series from this one director who did something like, I don't know, 7, I think, of these Godzilla movies, and they are actually Japanese in that sense, because it's a little while after the war. It's very interesting politically because it actually was this Japanese movie saying that, you know, the H-bombs had caused this mutated monster to come and destroy them all.
That was a big issue, wasn't it?
It was really interesting, and then the Americans just pinched it and put in Raymond Burr looking wise. And the other thing that David and I were saying, well, in fact, all of us, having sat through interminable lectures with scientists, was that was your stereotype, boring scientist lecture, and they happen still. It wasn't at all.
My university days were spent watching that kind of thing, yeah.
We had a lecturer in zoology who I won't name, who would repeat every sentence twice. We had a lecturer in zoology who I won't name who would repeat every sentence twice. And it was really hard to stay awake, I can tell you.
Then you also had a lecturer, I won't repeat it, who also will remain nameless, who used to have every third slide a nude woman, which was very enlightening in the 70s.
Oh, yes. Very sensible. Is there anything else you want to say about this? Because in the social context of Japan after the war, this is a very significant film. So, Barbara, are you familiar with Japanese monster movies?
Not intimately, no. But I think it's very much dealing with the same kinds of issues as King Kong. The monster is there because it symbolises a lot of fears and anxieties released into the culture after the dropping of the atomic bombs after World War II. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's stated quite baldly that that's how the monsters emerged, but it comes to become a sort of huge symbol, and because there were so many remakes and additions, as Gail's mentioned, suggests that this would have troubled the Japanese people for many years afterwards, that, you know, what is unleashed or what has been unleashed by the dropping of these bombs, because not only would they have been confronted with dreadful disfigurations for years later and the birth of a lot of mutated embryos and so forth.
I think it's worth commenting, though, that this mutation theory or the damage of radiation purports to produce these new species, so-called, but they wouldn't be new species unless they could reproduce, and most of the damage from radiation makes you infertile. Yeah. So it's sort of a slightly flawed argument, I think.
Dealt with within the next Godzilla movie, where the monster can reproduce at will.
Yes, we do. Well, look, we're almost out of time, so I think we might just wind up by discussing very briefly how Hollywood's doing, how Hollywood's coping with science. We've seen it from the early 1930s up to as recently as this year. Are they getting better, Barbara?
The special effects are unbelievable, I think. Yes. I mean, recent Hollywood science fiction movies are unbelievable to watch. They're becoming actually spectacles in themselves, where the pleasure's almost simply in looking at the way in which the monster is appearing and changing and presenting itself. Just a spectacle of sort of astonishment.
The way the dinosaurs hopped around in Jurassic Park, you know, like a flock of emus, that was tremendous.
Yeah, but I still say the scariest monster of all is the one you hear and don't see, the one that's off frame. You know, that you can build so much tension in a movie by not showing the monster, and it's a heck of a lot cheaper to make.
Yeah. the great thing about Hollywood movies now is it gives me, as somebody who comments on... I'm a filmmaker myself, of course, and I make for programs of Pioneer Productions, and our graphics budget is absolutely awesome. I mean, every series we make, the graphics budget is about $200,000. But the other great thing about Hollywood movies, they're now sort of coming in more or less at a cost of around about £200 million, which is the average cost of a space mission. So when people say to me that space missions are a waste of money, I say, well, they're just the cost of a Hollywood movie.
I think Hollywood, for all of its flaws, I think all in all they fuel public interest in the things that scientists are on about. We can pick their work apart all day long. It's very easy to do, but I think what they do is they tweak the interest of the public and direct the attention of the public to the science that's being done, whereas usually we're busy in our laboratories and doing behind the scenes, changing people's lives behind the scenes. And Hollywood is able, through story and through science fiction, to bring people into the laboratory, even though it's a bit bogus, and give them a taste of what things are like.
Yeah, I read that Arnold Schwarzenegger in Junior, you know, where Arnold Schwarzenegger gives birth to a baby from his tummy, was actually inspired by an article from Scientific American, which argued this is actually feasible and possible. But you know, to me, these are sort of modern fairy stories and parables, in a way.
It was classified as a comedy, but I thought it was a horror film, personally.
I think it's interesting that Hollywood, even at its most extreme, is one of the really potent vehicles for looking at the social implications of science and research and technology, because often it is made by people who are not scientifically literate at all, and what they're doing is actually reflecting what a lot of people are really frightened about or concerned about. And in that sense, you do have some kind of, you know, community feedback or communication between the public at large and scientists, and put it a little bit more in perspective, even if it is quite extreme. And quite often it's actually not that extreme.
And some of them are really nice, like Contact, which is not at all, you know, it's a very kind of positive look at space, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, the desire behind these films is to try and embrace the other, the alien, an E.T., you know?
Yeah.
So where to now for Hollywood? Are there new horizons for Hollywood to tackle, or are we just going to keep churning over the old thing?
Back to vegetables.
Back to vegetables? Okay.
I think David's right, though. The more genetic stuff, I think that's going to be the major revolution. I think we should be looking at all the possible implications of changing human beings completely and all the cloning type stuff, and where all that's going to take us.
I agree entirely.
Yeah, it's an interesting point.
That's the
actually
film I'm writing.
Yeah, okay. Okay, you're going to be a millionaire, are you?
Oh, yeah, fat chance.
Yeah.
I've tried and tried. Oh, you've hurt me now. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much for being at our third annual Hollywood Meets the Lab Coats. We didn't have any lab coats at all, but please thank our panel, the Davids, the Barbara, the Heather, all the people on the panel. And we'll see you next year for the fourth annual Hollywood Meets the Lab Coats. Thank you, everybody. Well done. Look behind you!